Thank you, Hadley, and it's an honor to be here for your excellent group, and the name of it, as well as its purpose, has a lot to do with the thesis that I have about social issues. But first, let me say a good word for polarization. Polarization is, if you think about it, if fundamental issues are at stake in politics, in an election, polarization is a tremendous service to the electorate. If the issues are fundamental, then you want clarity. You want transparency as to which side is for what and what those results will lead to. We have polarization in the United States. We don't have it in Europe. Social conservatism, I must say, is the cause of polarization in the United States. If we didn't have social conservatism, we wouldn't have nearly as much polarization. Now, Europe doesn't have any polarization in their politics, none that you could really shake a stick at. And did the voters, when they decided to go down the path that they have gone down toward an overweening entitlement state, a complete triumph of the sexual revolution without any remaining opposition, and wound up with being governed from Brussels and Strasbourg, making their big decisions on most economic and governmental issues, and they have a fertility rate down in the lower half of the ones, and basically they're going out of business because of politics, because of decisions that have been made in terms of their basic values. Did the voters of Europe ever really argue that out? Or did it just kind of come about by a process of cultural osmosis? It all happened in the culture, and it certainly happened in the culture here. I mean, I'm not saying that the cultural conservative or social conservative side is in great shape, but certainly there's resistance here, and virtually all of the resistance is in politics. It isn't in universities. It isn't in Hollywood. The resistance is in politics, the fact that popular opinion has traces of social conservatism. So we have polarization because we have social conservatism. And why do we? Well, the usual answer is we're more religious. We have more church going here than they do in Europe. Cathedrals are empty over there, and although religion has had some decline here, it's still a very serious force. Quite a number of people do go to church. But my own feeling is, and that gets us back to the title of our colloquium of your institution that you're building here, Hadley, is that we're probably more religious because of the nature of our founding. We believe that our rights come directly from God. We believe that all men were created equal, not that they achieve equality through cultural progression of self-discovery, always led by a political elite, a vanguard class. We believe that we've had it all along. Now, we may define equality. We do define equality very differently, that each person has a soul, that each person has a dignity. We must accord that dignity to them in the present. It's not a process going forward that we're going to arrive at this equality. We have it from the beginning. And that is very different from Europe. The European constitutions don't have these ideas. Stan Evans, a conservative theoretician, said, God is mentioned in some of the French constitutions, but it's more like a notary public, like he had to be present at the founding. He didn't have an awful lot to do with creating and stating the rights that we take for granted here. So my feeling is that we have more religion because we have a better founding. And when you think about it, the Enlightenment did go in two different directions. There's what I call the left Enlightenment, which started in, really, it's very specific. It's very easy to identify where it got started. It was in Paris, in the 1790s, where the French National Assembly, the Jacobins, and their radical allies sat on the left side of that assembly, and that was the beginning of the left. And here, the conservative Enlightenment, although it shared the left Enlightenment's desire to get rid of kings and aristocrats, we did not share their willingness to throw religion overboard, to abolish the Catholic Church, to put the Goddess of Reason up in Notre Dame Cathedral, which they did under Robespierre. And in fact, the only thing that would have justified getting rid of an institution that has been as ubiquitous and universal as monarchy or the nobility was an appeal directly to God and the idea that God created us all as equals, not as people who have superior stature by means of blood. And so, yes, that's a more radical view than what they were trying to do in Paris. It compels instantaneous recognition of our God-given equal dignity. But it's also much more conservative. We weren't willing at our founding to throw out the history of Judaism, of Christianity, Aristotle, Plato. We weren't willing to throw all those things out. In fact, an appeal to them made us more able to get rid of aristocracy and monarchy than was the case in Europe, where aristocracy and monarchy mounted quite a comeback and were still very much around as late as 1914. So we had a different kind of enlightenment, and our founding is the reason why, when the left scored their greatest triumph, their greatest offensive against civilization as we know it, and that was in the 1960s and into the 1970s, with the upheaval in institutions and politics, 10 million people on strike in Paris, of all places. The left won without opposition on the cultural issues and the social issues. They won overwhelmingly among elites here, but popular opinion resisted, and we still have that resistance. So social conservatism is not some leftover from a more settled era. Social conservatism is something that arose in this country in the late 1960s and the 1970s as a reaction based on the founding, I believe. I believe that is the greatest indicator of why we have it, and it is the foundation of social conservatism in America and why we have it here, and they don't have it elsewhere in Western Europe and Japan, and that is the reason. But it is a new movement, and in the time that it has existed since the late 60s and 70s, when it started coming into politics, when it started turning, popping up in presidential elections, it has always been underrated. Social conservatism gets an obituary every 3 or 4 months. When you get some setback, it is predicted to be on its last legs or already dead. And you can find such predictions all the way through the political journalism of the last 40 or 50 years, and somehow it never happens. One of my rules of thumb, by the way, is that if you hear that if something is pronounced dead in politics, in a political context, whether it's social conservatism or supply-side economics or neoconservatism, when it's pronounced dead repeatedly, you know it isn't. Now, in Western Europe, nobody says social conservatism is dead. They don't have to say it because it is dead there. There's no such thing. But if you keep hearing these premature obituaries, you'll know that something is definitely alive and kicking. Well, what is the left? What is this thing? Is it about socialism? Is it about big government? Well, it's sometimes been about that, but it's protean. It takes different shapes depending on the opportunity at hand and the larger trend in society. Socialism was a big deal on the left for about 100 years, but it isn't now. It's rarely mentioned. You get the results of it, God knows, and Obamacare and other things that Hadley alluded to, but they don't try to say that the government should own the means of production. That just doesn't come up very often. But what has always come up on the left is the desire to destroy the existing institutions of society. Yes, monarchy and the aristocracy, which our revolution wanted to get rid of too, but more fundamentally and more emotionally, religion, organized religion, remember that goddess of reason that was set up in Notre Dame, and the family, the traditional family. So when people say that the Communist Party of China, that that's no longer a country of the left because they have a lot of entrepreneurship and a lot of banks and a lot of businesses and a lot of capitalists, the one thing that they don't give up, yes, Deng Xiaoping got rid of Maoist socialism, but what are their big hot buttons? Well, let's see. It's the one-child rule for the nuclear family, and it is making illegal any religious movement that poses an independence from the government. And that's, yes, it's Christianity, Protestantism, Catholicism. It's also the neo-Buddhist meditation movement of Falun Gong. So in my book, China is still a regime of the left because they have the definition that dates back to the 1790s when the word the left was first invented. Now, where did Robespierre and the Jacobins, where did they get it from? Well, it's really there in Rousseau more than anybody else. Rousseau died 11 years before 1789, before the outbreak of the French Revolution. The French Revolution wasn't all on the left in the initial phases. A lot of them were parliamentary reformers, and they were all anti-monarchists, just about. But a lot of them wanted direct rule by the people. But the Jacobins quickly took power and transformed it, and they transformed European politics over subsequent decades. And Rousseau believed that humanity had to get back to its natural state. He believed and argued that when mankind was more primitive, before civilization had even gotten started, people were happy. It was a kind of secular version of the Garden of Eden. And in that vision, which, by the way, was shared by Marx, you can find it in his writing from the 1850s, nobody had any obligation to anyone else. You did whatever you felt like. There's a famous passage in Marx where after dinner I fed the animals and then I talked about great books and did whatever I felt like. But there's no reference to the obligations and relationships that most of us find in real life. It's an autonomous freedom, and it is a freedom without any standards. And it is also without God. It's just man in his most natural state as Rousseau imagined it. Others don't think that it existed in the past, but they definitely want to move toward it. And that is the core of the left. That is what is always there in the left, no matter what other causes it takes up or what forms it takes shape as. And why did they suddenly break through? I mean, they had plenty of victories, plenty of defeats, but the thing that really brought the left to power, to cultural power, and on the verge of taking over global politics was the sexual revolution. Now let's go back to the 60s. There was a lot of political and economic content in the various rebellions, and they broke out all over the world. You had the Cultural Revolution in China, students being shot in the streets in Mexico, the Paris strike that started on universities. In this country, it was the free speech movement in Berkeley and going on to riots in Columbia and Harvard, I'm sure here in Amherst, although I don't remember those. A smaller school, but I'm sure you had your version of it, Cornell. But the political part of it, the chaotic part of it, was beaten back. Ronald Reagan rose to prominence in California as an opponent of the new left, the unrest on campuses. There was simultaneous unrest in black ghettos. But the core of the left movement was definitely, it started on campus, and It was all about going after the existing institutions of society. The political part of it was put down. The economic part of it, the equality of result of the Maoists in China during their Cultural Revolution, were extolling to the point where party members and generals had to lose their rank, and party members were sent out into the fields because you had to have equality of economic result. But all of that passed by the board. The part of it that worked politically was the sexual part. And there's a surprising nexus in the early parts of the sexual revolution. There's a word that has now been completely forgotten. The word is parietals. You remember that word, Hadley? You go back to the beginning of the free speech movement, the first campus unrest in Berkeley, and it was about rules as to what boys could do in girls' dorms and vice versa, and when they had to be out of the rooms. You go to Danny the Red at the University of Nanterre, where the whole thing started 4 years later in France, and guess what it's about? It's about sex. It's about boys and girls being thrown together in a situation of some restriction, but they wanted complete freedom, and almost without exception, the university administrators gave it to them. They were winning on sex when they were losing on economics and politics. The last thing I will say about this is how did it get such momentum? Well, part of it was there was a kind of urban myth about the population bomb, the population issue, where countries were going to go out of business if too many people were born. Now we know in Western Europe and Japan, even in the Islamic world, that exactly the reverse is true, that the problem for the existential problem for society is when too few babies are being born per nuclear family. But at that time, it really caught on, and the pill came on in 1960. But politically speaking, the big breakthrough was the recruitment of the feminist movement to the sexual revolution. Now, I'm old enough. I was going to college in 61. I started out. But let's just say in 1960, around the same time that the pill came in, the idea that women would be in favor of the Playboy mentality. I mean, Hugh Hefner was a complete sexist. He believed that women were objects. And he made it very clear in every issue of his magazine. The last thing that an educated woman would want to do in 1959 is join up with the sexual revolution, as it was even then starting to be called. But how they managed to pull that off, to get women to think that the sexual revolution was in their interest, that they would be happier and freer, and of course Betty Friedan and Simone de Beauvoir argued very explicitly, the thing keeping women back is not the lack of a vote, it isn't perceptions about them. It's their husbands and their children. Both Betty Friedan and Simone de Beauvoir. Simone de Beauvoir, the first intellectual feminist, Betty Friedan, the American who popularized radical feminism all over the world, they were very clear that the enemy of women is the nuclear family. That wasn't the case before, to put it mildly. Certainly not in their perception. But once that was sold, and when you combined it with the urban myth of the population bomb, the trick was done, and women embraced the sexual revolution. Not all women, obviously, but upper crust women, the feminist movement, embraced it. And that was the most successful move, I would argue, that the left has ever made in their entire history. With socialism, the proletarian revolt, and all those other things they tried, the Cultural Revolution, this was the key. And the problem is, when the sexual revolution wins, fertility declines. And it was declining. There were even treatises written about why in France, in the first half of the 19th century, was there a population problem. Why France, the biggest country in Europe in 1800, why was it declining? Why was it getting static and less populous in comparison to Britain and Germany through the first half of the 19th century. So this idea has always been present in the left. The sexual revolution, the attack on the family, the attack on traditional religion has always been there on the left, and it's always had at least the beginnings of these results. But now that the sexual revolution and the left are one and the same, it has posed an existential problem all over the world. Philip Longman, liberal writer, in The Empty Cradle. I mean, the declines in fertility are just as fast in the Islamic world as the idea of population control has become more and more universal, even in fairly religious countries. So the left, as we get to the end of the road, here more than 200 years after its foundation, it turns out that it is an exercise in self-destruction. And social conservatism is the only mass-based movement at the moment, certainly in the industrialized world, that is resisting that. So as long as that is true, as long as social conservatism in the United States, and it is only American now, there are a few glimmers of it elsewhere, but I would concede that it is a specifically American phenomenon, I believe because of the founding. But then again, Hadley, I don't believe that the American founding is a matter of exceptionalism in the sense of, well, we're the only ones who can ever embrace it. So if social conservatism is able to survive and continue giving a good account of itself, continuing to make those many, many, many obituaries about its demise, to keep falsifying them, then I think there is hope for the world. I think there are only really three universal political visions left. One is the vision of the left. One is Islam, which certainly in the form that we see in recent decades is something that subjects religion to a political vision. It doesn't really see a distinction between the two, politics and religion. And the third is social conservatism, which is the only mass-based version of the conservative Enlightenment, which had such a huge impact in the United States and in the Britain of the 19th century. So that's where we're at. And since it is, I believe, increasingly an existential issue for the societies that are threatened by the left, then the fight is unavoidable. And those who, whether it's in the Republican Party or wherever, who think that this is one we can punt on, are going to be proven wrong, and social conservatism is going to continue to have a surprisingly high impact on the politics of our time. Thank you.
I was going to draw more on your book to say where it still plays right now in our politics. You thought it had a real difference in 2004. Could you say something more about that?
Post-Reagan elections, they were very big in the 80s, in the realignment of the 80s when Reagan was running. But in the elections after Reagan, there are only two where it came to the fore and gained a dominant role in a presidential campaign. 1988, when you had the furloughs and membership of ACLU, and abortion came up in a presidential debate. And 2004, where judicial imposition of same-sex marriage became a huge issue, and the exit polls indicated a decisive issue in favor of the second Bush. Those are the only two elections where it came up and played a prominent role. Oh, and by the way, those also happened to be the only two presidential elections where the Republican Party won the popular vote. In all those other post-Reagan elections where it didn't come up, the Republican Party lost the popular vote. And so it doesn't come up in the advertising. God knows. We haven't seen it in the advertising, even though Obama's extremism on these issues is quite notable, quite extraordinary, on the HHS mandate, on same-sex marriage, on the kinds of abortion that he wants to be legal, including those after birth, as Hadley has been a pioneer in pointing out. And yet, you don't see it in the ads. Where it does tend to come up, and it was certainly true in both 1988 and 2004, is in presidential debates. So even though it has been largely absent even though as a glaring vulnerability of the incumbent administration, it's been a peripheral matter in the advertising of the two campaigns, I really, you know, if it comes up, it's going to come up in the debates and become a factor in the last month. Another thing is the cultural propaganda. Longman looked at a number of surveys where women were asked when their fertility starts to decline. They had no idea that at the age of 35, it really goes down. They didn't know that.
It starts much earlier than that.
It starts much earlier, but they didn't know that at 35, most women are done, or at least it's very hard. I mean, it becomes a major issue to try to have children after 35 for most women. And so a lot of it is cultural propaganda, that women are, they have the idea, well, I can get married, I can have this part of my career, I can get married at my 32 or 33, and then, well, we'll get a little more surplus, a little more resources, and then 37, 38, maybe I'll have my kids. And it turns out that they can't. So I think if women... It seems to have actually happened in Japan, I would have to say, that women have just decided they don't want to have children or get married. I mean, a lot of women seem to have decided that. But the surveys at Longman cited indicated that that just isn't true, that if economic and cultural conditions were different, that women would have a lot of children. Also, you described abortion as a backup for the pill. It's becoming a rather decisive factor. If a country has legalized abortion, that in itself accounts for the birth rate, the fertility rate going from 2.8 down to, you know, the mid ones where it is now, or 1.7 or 1.8. Just the legalized abortion alone, yes, of course, the pill prevents many births, but legalized abortion, if it were much more restricted, there's some indication that that in and of itself could greatly increase the fertility rate. So I take your points, but I think the fundamental question to ask about women is, have they stopped wanting to have babies at all? And I don't think there's too much survey evidence of that.
Does this line of thinking about, I guess, women and when it comes to abortion rights and as it comes to, I guess, feminism, is this kind of, the reason you put forth, doesn't it sort of treat women as if they're some sort of, I guess, baby-making kind of, like, factory like that? When you just talk about, like, the raw sense of, like, how many children they're having in terms of what they do to help the economy as creating persons, you kind of, doesn't that kind of diminish all the other
parts? Well, I haven't figured out a way around that one. But the truth is that women don't have babies to perpetuate the population, the human race. And earlier feminists, Susan B. Anthony and feminists around the turn of the century, were not at all anti-marriage and were not at all anti-childbirth. That's just a fact. This is something that has come in on modern feminism when feminism became a subset of the left. Now, I can't tell you as a man that I can say exactly why women, or certainly elite women, have accepted Betty Friedan's and Simone de Beauvoir's ethic in terms of saying that the greatest threat to women and their fulfillment is getting married and having children with your husband. But what I can tell you as a historical fact is that earlier feminists who were very radical in their own way and very successful in advancing the role of women, some of the greatest advances of women came in the 19th and earlier 20th centuries, they didn't have that view. They simply were not anti-women, at least not the vast majority of them. Yes? Anti-children or anti-men.
Wanted to ask a question about political strategy. Your comment about how there seems to be a conspiracy, so to speak, between the elites of both political parties not to bring these issues up. And I'm struck by the parallel between that and the progressive era, where there were progressives in the left, in the Democratic and the Republican Party, but their views had basically, for various reasons, were not being expressed through the traditional political process. And this is where they came about the idea of ballot initiative. And in the case of cultural conservatism, I'm struck by the observation that, you know, it seems to me that cultural conservatives perhaps constitute the majority of the country, except that they are split between the two parties. And moreover, African Americans tend to be culturally conservative but will not consider voting for the Republican Party. You see the same thing with poor whites in the South, religious Catholics in the North, culturally conservative but would never vote for the Democratic Party. And I wonder the extent to which the ballot initiative would be a way to unite these, because, of course, the divisions across the two parties is what enables the elites to keep this from becoming an issue.
Mm-hmm.
We've already seen success with gay marriage ballot initiatives, especially Prop 8 in California. I wonder if you could comment on the extent to which that is a viable political strategy moving forward and how it could be expanded.
Well, I think that relates into the judicial part of this issue, because the essence of Roe versus Wade is to say the states have no role, the people cannot vote on this, they cannot legislate at the local and state level. So I didn't mention it in my remarks, but certainly the judicial element and the interpretation of where these issues should lie is an important dimension there. I would also argue that 2012 has seen a kind of watershed on the Democratic side. Now, Bill Clinton played down the cultural aspects of the Democratic platform when he used terms like on abortion, like safe, legal, and rare. That's out. That's out of the platform. There's no more rare. There's no more abortion is a tragic choice that is necessitated by some circumstances. There's nothing tragic anymore. It's like praised. It's the Democrats, yes, they do have a lot of pro-life voters, but they're driving them out. I believe it's ideological. I don't think it's a pragmatic thing on the part of President Obama and Valerie Jarrett and the rest of those people. I believe it is an ideological imperative. I think they're taking enormous risks by, in effect, saying, if we win our fight against the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church will be forced out of adoption, forced out of schools, forced out of social helping institutions all over the country. If they don't give in, if they don't pay for things that they don't believe in, they will be forced out. That is a very radical position. I think it's kind of a layup for Mitt Romney to make a big deal out of it. And maybe he will before this is over. Everything he said about it when he's been asked has been good. But you're absolutely right. The Republicans by saying, well, let's just do this under the radar. We'll do it in the direct mail and in phone banks. They're making a big mistake because I agree with you, Jay. There are plenty of social and cultural conservatives who still vote Democratic. But the Democrats right now are the biggest force in making that at least potentially an anomaly. Yes, sir.
I have a question about the two revolutions and foundings you talked about in your talk, the American founding and its principles in 1789 and the French Revolution. Oftentimes, I think that people say that what we're fighting about in politics is the founders and whether people are adhering to the founders' vision or whether they're not, and the founding principles or whether they're not. But you mentioned both revolutions. You talked about 1789 and the division that resulted from that. So in your view, what are we fighting about in our politics? Are we fighting about 1776 or are we fighting about 1789?
I think we're fighting about both. We're fighting about what the upshot of the Enlightenment is going to be. The Enlightenment was the greatest movement in Europe and ultimately in the world in the 17th and 18th centuries. And for a while, it was one movement, but then they diverged in the late 18th century. England at first, or actually in the middle of the, you could even say in the late 17th century, when there was an English version and then a continental version. There were outliers, people like Montesquieu in France were supporters of the conservative Enlightenment, as I call it. But a big fight started as to what the Enlightenment is. What is the essence of the Enlightenment that has transformed society? Is it anti-religious? Is it anti-family or pro-family? Everybody agrees that the Enlightenment means that monarchy and blood rule, aristocracy or other, is a declining force. But what has not been resolved is whether we have to throw everything out to get back to Rousseau's version of natural man, or whether the things that were good and widely supported in the Western world prior to the Enlightenment, whether some of them can and should be preserved. So we're still having that fight, in my opinion. And it's being fought out increasingly all over the Third World, too. Yes?
You made a case about where kind of liberal launch pad for modern liberalism or leftism is in that partnership with radical feminists and in particular with the power of birth, you know, sexual technology and so forth. So that's where it comes from, the success comes from. How is it perpetuated? How, I mean, by the nature of the way they've gained this power, it, you know, it doesn't reproduce itself.
Yeah, literally. Exactly.
So you need to mint new leftists somewhere. Is that what we send our kids to college for? Or?
Exactly, there you go. And that's why your institution here at Amherst is... It's right in the fundamental, the global, the macro issues, but you're absolutely right. That's the front line, because they're not having that many babies, and so they have to take over our babies. And college and high school are the usual places where they manage to do that. But it, ultimately, the left is about self-liquidation. It's happening everywhere where they take over and they completely control the culture and politics, at least on these issues. Nada. No more babies. I mean, at the rate we've all seen the numbers, Western Europe in 2050 is not going to exist in any sense that we could recognize. And so, ultimately, the triumph of the left, I don't think they designed it this way. I think it was maybe even a bit of a surprise to some of them. There was a very affirmative and very optimistic vision of the left and what could be accomplished and the happiness you would have if they won. But now winning means extinction for the societies where they win.
So is this a case where the left's self-liquidation, really the only question left is what will ultimately fill in that vacuum? Will it be traditional Western social conservatism, or will it be Islam?
That's right. I think that's essentially that's the case, because the left is no longer dynamic.
You refer to both the first wave feminists and first wave feminists and the second wave feminists, but one very important characteristic of the third wave feminists is that they advocated a diversity of choices and like women choosing family or not choosing family. Would you argue that the decline in fertility rate is entirely due to this kind of cultural propaganda, or would you concede that it's partly due to women's choice out of their agency? And
well, there's a meme, as we say these days, around that says that the real variable is women's education. When women become more educated, then they don't want to have any more children. Now, that's happening. That's certainly happening. The education's going up and the children are going down in a whole bunch of countries. But historically, it has not, in fact, been true. Look at Victorian England. The greatest economic growth of all time, and yet a rise of monogamy, of the nuclear family, of childbearing, even in a lot of the upper middle classes. So women gaining more wealth, more power, more education has not always corresponded, or society, I think more narrowly I should say, society having a dynamic economic period has not at all always coincided with women stopping their childbirth. So I think it has to do with ideology. I think there's an ideology involved. I hope that there will be a blend in feminism that gets them back to a pro-family version of feminism, or at least partly pro-family, as you suggest. But I'm just a spectator. I don't entirely understand it. All I know is that there isn't too much evidence that women have given up on the idea of getting married and having children in terms of when they're asked about it. The sexual revolution, one of the things it means is that the men don't have to get married to have a lot of sex anymore. So, you know, that's a problem for women. Ultimately, I think it's a big problem for men, too.
Look, let me just try to get back to your book, though. Though it is true that the surveys over the years indicate that support for abortion has always been stronger among men than among women, and upper-class Protestant men among men. But I'm getting back to your argument about the book. The argument has been that, the pro-life issue has been a net winner for the conservative candidate. It's like a 5% increment. And if that's the case, then how do you explain why the conservative party has been so reluctant to use it? And you think it's still the same increment right now?
Oh, I think it could be bigger than that. I mean, I think it's moved. There's been some elections where it moved a lot more voters. Just to take the exit polls from 2004,
Ohio.
Not just Ohio, nationally, it was 20% said their big issue was values. This was at a time when Iraq was a big debate. You know, a lot of other things were happening at the time, and yet 20 points of the turnout said that they were values voters, and of those, that's in both directions, whether pro-choice, pro-anti-values, or pro-values, or pro-life. 17 percentage points of those went for George W. Bush. 3 percentage points of that went to John Kerry. Now, that it was in a cycle when the social issues were prominent, when Rehnquist was dying, kind of visibly dying in the days before the election. A lot of different factors came into play there that made social issues such a surprising part of the 2004 elections. But I think it could be more than 5 points. But I would also say that Bush didn't want to talk about it.
That's right.
And he did a good job in the third and final debate, and that was the one where Kerry kind of lost it and said, Dick Cheney's daughter, who is a lesbian, you know, she thinks it happens from birth. He didn't even mention her name, Mary. He just obviously got angry, and it was the only time in the debate when Kerry kind of had some bad moments. Bush did a good job of explaining why he thought the people should ultimately decide rather than judges. But Bush talked about it very reluctantly, and I don't know. I could give you a lot of different soap opera theories, that type of thing, but ultimately, if the Republicans don't run as integrated across-the-board conservatives the way Reagan did, and that means on economics, it means on social issues, it means on foreign policy, they're going to be leaving a lot of potential and a lot of votes on the table.
George Nash and Alan, yeah.
What do you make of the argument that social conservatism is dying out because it is a phenomenon of older people, and that the under 30 demographic is increasingly indifferent to social conservatism?
Well, with the demographics, the birth rates the way they are, I mean, we found out that during the financial crisis, our birth rate went down below replacement level from 2.1 to 1.9. And I understand that if you're on a college campus, if you're a student on a college campus and you're against same-sex marriage, there are real problems getting your degree. I mean, it's kind of a universally dictated value. So I think that the unanimity against social issues among the young is kind of an inflicted thing to some degree. And in previous generations, it looked like they were very liberal. And then when they got out and into the world and formed families and had children, they got much more conservative. Now the problem is they're not forming that many families. They're not having that many children. So this is a different qualitative problem in a way. Yeah.
Why the Republicans don't talk about it. It it seems to me that a major problem that the party, the Republican Party, has is that, you know, African Americans are overwhelmingly more likely to be socially conservative than whites.
Very true.
Which is why Prop 8 passed in 2008 despite the Obama wave. And yet the Republican Party, you know, 25 years ago could win 15% of the African American vote, but now it's going to win 5%. It seems to me that as long as Republicans have no purchase in the African American community, that they're limited to electoral victory has to be limited to white suburban females in and around Columbus who are pro-choice and who were, you know, liked Bill Clinton and socially moderate. I wonder if that's the core problem. And there's an additional problem as well with the Hispanic vote. Right. Hispanics vote more Republican than African Americans do, but lower income Hispanics, you see, the Hispanic vote divides on a socioeconomic scale, where the lowest socioeconomic Hispanics tend to be Catholic, tend to be culturally conservative, but tend not to vote Republican. And my concern is that those African-Americans and Hispanics in that socioeconomic scale don't even consider the Republican Party as a viable political option. And I wonder if that's the real problem for forming, if there is, in fact, in the United States of America, if there is, in fact, an enduring socially conservative majority, the problem is that the Republican Party has failed as a vehicle for that because it has alienated African Americans and lower income Hispanics.
Okay, two problems. One is there's a huge Protestant vote among Hispanics. They tend to go toward the Republicans.
Yes, right.
People don't realize how many of the Latino community in this country are conservative, evangelical Protestants. They do tend to go for the Republican Party. You're right about the Catholics. And it's also true that the Spanish-speaking Catholics are more likely to be socially conservative, and as they get acculturated, they get a little less socially, somewhat less socially conservative. Right now, the group I'm with, American Principles Project, is conducting an experiment in Nevada and Colorado. We have exclusively Spanish language ads on that talk about defending marriage and pro-life and against the HHS mandate. We also, the first wave of ads that we did in Nevada had to do with Obama being the deporter in chief. Obama has deported illegal immigrants at a far greater rate than any previous president. And that was not widely known. It is widely known in the Hispanic community. The Republican Party should be like Ronald Reagan was, welcoming of immigration. Of course, we want it to be legal. But when you attack illegal immigration within a certain tone of voice, they get the idea that we don't like them. We don't want them to come. Certainly from a social conservative point of view, we do want them to come. And from a demographic point of view, because they have more babies, we want them to come. Even an economic point of view, I would argue, because they have a high rate of entrepreneurship. So we do have to get rid of that barrier that our anti-immigration policies have set up. But after that, I think there's a lot of promise there. Blacks, I think, post-Obama are a possibility, particularly if social issues come to the fore. They're not going to vote against Obama. Nobody has any illusions about that. But and why should they? There's no reason why they should even consider it, because he's a point of pride to them. But if the Democrats carry on with the attitude that they had at their recent national convention on making gay marriage a point of conformity and going after the Catholic Church, having a very extreme position on abortion where they don't even say that it should be rare, I think that they could start to drive, in the post-Obama election, some blacks, particularly if social issues come more to the fore and are more a part of the dialogue.
I think that first of all, it's hard to fathom how actuarial presidential campaigns have become. I was involved in national politics many years ago, and have kept in touch with some people. And anything that we're talking about, they know. And they are polling and polling and polling, and just as Dick Morris wrote, they're polling on a much more sophisticated level than what Gallup is doing. I often wonder why Gallup does what it does or why he publishes this. But these guys are very, very sophisticated. That doesn't mean they're carrying out a good campaign. Doesn't mean a lot of things. And I think that these all speculation, but that the resistance to discuss these issues is simply because these issues are emotional and they work in both ways. And the actuaries who are really running the campaign have sliced up and diced the population, and they know where their votes are in each state. They know the background. They know the Protestants, the Catholics, the Jews, the blacks, the pinks, the blues, the chartreuses. They know it all. And they know exactly who they're appealing to, and this is just like plain old Procter & Gamble marketing. And I think they've concluded, from what I'm told, that it's the dog whisperer is the latest phrase. I happen to have a couple of dogs, so I'm familiar with dog whispering. I think that the Republicans are assuming that the people who feel certain ways about certain issues are going to figure that out, and that if they make blatant appeals to them, they lose non-committed. And any time you look at the polls, you're really looking at this small little piece of the population that has a chance to win. And so I think that these are emotional issues, and their view is we've got nothing but downside.
Well, I would go back to what Jay said a few minutes ago. There are a lot of Democrats who don't know that the social conservative issues are at stake, that we are at a fundamental turning point. If Obama wins, I have absolutely no doubt that gay marriage will be imposed by the Supreme Court before his term is over. But I don't think the average voter out in the Midwest knows that. I don't think it's been brought to his or her attention. And as Jay said, there are many, many millions of Democrats. Now, this dog whistle, this under-the-radar thing, it gets to the people who have already realigned and makes them more likely to turn out, which does have a utility. But if it is correct that many, many Democrats are, on the social conservative side on marriage and abortion, and the issues don't become prominent, you don't get to them with the dog whistles. They just don't know. They're not aware of how out of touch their party has become. So, yes, I know that's what they think. That's what the actuaries, as you call them, that's the way they think. But I think they underestimate the degree to which there's an imbalance in where a lot of voters still are.
Mike Platt.
Yeah, I have a question about you're a close observer of politics, and I'm not close to these things. What do you think the intention and the ultimate intention is of the Obama administration and Sebelius's assault on the Catholic and evangelical hospitals? The most serious part of that is not contraception, it's abortifacts.
Right, I agree.
That is asking people of conscience to provide things that will kill what we think are babies or on the way to babies with all the consequences for population that are maybe intended or unintended by the left. What are they thinking? That at least the Catholic hierarchy has only had maybe one higher official repent from passing the predatory priests around. In other words, not a lot of moral courage there. And so they're betting, I think it would take five bishops to say something like to Sebelius and Obama, we're not shutting down our hospital. You send your troops. But they're betting that wouldn't happen. Now, if they're betting that, all right, that means capitulation. It means overcoming their conscience, getting them to roll over. Then, and I thought you maybe indicated this, then all of that hospital work falls into Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
Does this seem plausible to you?
Well, to go back to the first part of your question, why do they do it? I don't think it was a political calculation. I think it is absolutely in their DNA, its core.
Yeah.
They believe in humiliating people who resist the sexual revolution. They want to humiliate the Catholic Church. They did not carefully calculate whether there would be enough of a backlash to cause problems. Now, most of the mandate doesn't kick in until August of next year. So they had that much calculation that they wanted to delay the major impact. But I believe they did it out of ideology. I believe they are willing to see the Catholic institutions close down if they don't capitulate. And it's Rousseau and Robespierre. It's the same impulse.
Let me just sort of, I can see we're inducing some more discomfort here than we anticipated. And but we're reminded what this is, what a polarized politics is, that we're really making explicit the things that really divide people, as you see that. As with the Aiken case, the fact that people take this so seriously, they're willing to overturn a judgment made about economics. But it really reminds me of Lincoln's lament on this matter of slavery. They say, where can we discuss it? We don't want to discuss it in the churches. It doesn't belong there. We don't want to discuss it in the schools. He says, it's the issue that cuts to the core of who is a human person. And we can't discuss it anywhere in our politics. When does life begin? Barack Obama said that question is beyond his pay grade. He must be the only one who went to the Harvard Law School, never learned how to look anything up. You know, they have all the textbooks on obstetric gynecology. You know, you look them up. But the question is it cuts to the issue: when is a human person? And you think that one of the functions of political statesmen is that they show the public how to talk about the issues that are at the core, even when they don't want to talk about them. How, as Lincoln said, you learn how to impart the central idea. It's not an easy task. But you say, well, that is the measure of statecraft. And what we seem to be getting now is the notion that we don't want to talk about it because we have a diminished notion of what the American people are able to talk about. We know what will press upon them. And it's a diminished sense of, and yet all the evidence suggests they care profoundly about these things, so profoundly that they're willing to make the decisions pivot on them, as in the case of Missouri. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, Jeff, thanks very much for getting us going here tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.